For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sale, and this week we're focusing on our furry friends. Alex Milway transports us to Big Sky Mountain and introduces us to Albert the Moose. We travel back in time to 9/11 and hear the remarkable true story of the guide dog who led a group of survivors to safety from the wreckage of one of the Twin Towers. And I learn about the long and varied role that horses have played in human history. That's all coming up on today's Read On.
Up on the mountain there is a cabin, a place for us all, alone on the lakeside. The stove's warm, there's always an open door. Food in the cupboards, firewood stacked in the log store. Now in the rafters, keeping a close watch over it all.
Big Sky Mountain, oh,
place of hope, a place for all.
Big Sky Mountain, oh,
place of hope, a place for all. Up on the mountain each day.
Alex Milway is the author and illustrator of the Hotel Flamingo series of books, and his legion of young fans are destined to fall in love with his new Big Sky Mountain series too. Set in the wilderness and inspired by his own childhood, the stories are a wonderful blend of shaggy talking animals, exploring nature, and learning about ecology. And Alex has even written an album of songs to accompany them. He joined me from his home on the Sussex coast. Alex Milway, welcome to Read On.
Hello, thanks ever so much for having me.
So, can you take us to the world of Big Sky Mountain?
Oh, yes. Well, Big Sky Mountain is really simply about a girl who goes to live with her grandma in a cabin in the middle of the wilderness on Big Sky Mountain. And it's completely removed from the modern world. So she's got no phone signal, there's no internet, there's no television, no radio, nothing. So it's just her gran, it's the only place you can go to. So that's where her gran lives, in this cabin. Yeah, so it's completely different to a normal life. So she has to learn how to survive, really, and do everything her grandma has done for the past 20, 30 years living alone. So she has to chop wood to start fire and keep the place warm. She has to live off the land a bit. She gets to know all the animals. It's really kind of a bit of wish fulfillment on my part in that feeling of going to live in the middle of nowhere where you can see all the stars in the sky and you can hear all the animals and you can just feel a part of the world, I think, a part of nature.
And she is surrounded by animals, all of whom are very happy to have a conversation with her and
yes,
give her an insight into their lives.
Well, this is true. I thought it'd be a really nice way of talking about humans and their relationships with the natural world and sort of the ecosystems that we're a part of, all of this sort of world of animals doing their thing to help us do our thing, and hopefully all together we can get on. So the best way of doing that was to have the animals talk, yeah, and have them just like normal characters. So it's very anthropomorphic. Yeah, they live their own lives really on the mountains, just like the human characters do.
And every one of them has a place in that ecosystem.
That's which right, is, yeah.
Which is something that a city girl like Rosa might not necessarily have realised before she got to the wilderness.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this was something I learned a lot about when I was researching it, and you know, I love reading nature books and stuff. And there, yeah, you kind of get removed a bit from that when you're living in a town and city. You know, everything is very human, and we have sewage systems, you know, and we have water supplies, we have electricity supplies, and all this. But out in the natural world, you all sort of have a place, and animals, actually a keystone species, which are really amazing creatures that do a lot for other creatures as well as themselves within the environment. Yeah, all of these animals actually have quite a major role to play in making the world safe and warm and happy and surviving, you know, all that sort of stuff. It was quite mind-blowing to read how things like beavers and stuff, what their roles they play in the landscape. So yeah, I'm really fascinated by this, by the way, the animals actually do play an important part in human survival.
It's very much a song of love to nature. And I believe that it's actually inspired by your own visits to your grandmother when you were a child.
That's right. Yeah, Gran looked after us a lot. We'd always be there at weekends or in half-term holidays. And Gran was quite a strong character, and she'd always be walking us up the Malvern Hills. I grew up in Herefordshire and she was in Malvern. And so we had this, whatever the weather, she would march us up these hills, and we'd be like 5 mile walks, 10 mile walks sometimes if we went both ways. And crikey, so we were, and I was only little, I'd be from sort of six onwards, I'd be going up those hills and expected to sort of enjoy it no matter what the weather. But Gran was great, you know, she really fostered a love of that sort of, I mean, it wasn't really wilderness, it was, you know, it was lovely and genteel and pretty and manicured, the Morven Hills, but still being up that high and the views and being amongst the weather really fosters a love of that for me.
The sky looks enormous when you're only six.
Yeah. It is, and just having the wind on your face and feeling the power of it all. Because we were caught up there in snowstorms, and even once we were up there when fires started up on the Morven Hills. And so you really feel a part of nature, even if it is quite, you know, looked after.
She sounds like quite a formidable character, your Nan.
She absolutely was. She used to do all sorts of things. Even up into an old age, up to sort of in her 60s, she had this moped. And she would go 30 miles, 25 miles to work on this moped up and down the hills. And she'd arrive with a big helmet on and looking like Darth Vader in these leather gears and outfits. And I don't know, it's really great to have a character like that when you're growing up. And she could be quite problematic at times because she was quite strong. And so you'd be in the middle of arguments with other people and you'd just be standing there as a little kid and there'd be arguments going on and you'd sort of sit back and watch it. But looking back, it's great to have been around characters, you know. It's really exciting sort of looking back and have stories that you can, you know, take elements from and put them into books. It's great.
Now, as anybody who's read any of your books, whether it's the Hotel Flamingo series or the Pig Six and Harold book,
yeah,
particular favourite of mine, you have very funny, very witty and very shaggy heroes in your books. And I think I sense that you've just been adding more fur to your characters as you've been going on. I didn't think you could get furrier than yetis, but...
No, they have lots of fur, yeah.
We now have Albert the Moose, who loves apples.
Yes. I love moose. I mean, we don't really have them in this country. I mean, we don't really have any megafauna, which is the name for, you know, giant... creatures, large creatures. There's still some around, you know, you have things like buffalo and even cows, I guess, are some, you know, these big creatures. But yeah, we don't really have moose. We have deer, which are quite large. But I really love moose. They seem to be quite gentle creatures that just sort of wander around. And obviously Europe's got them, the continental Europe and North America. But Albert's lovely. And I love the idea that their horns grow back every year. They lose these massive horns, which is one of the big sort of jokes in the book, in that he always pokes his head through the window, but he always gets stuck because his horns are too big. And how does he get them in? We don't know, but he manages to get them in, but he can't get them out. And so he needs a help from Grandma Nan to get them out. But yeah, they're such sweet, lovely characters. They're just roaming the wilderness. I love them.
You obviously have done all the illustrations again, and yeah, you just have a huge cast of animal characters to choose from. Is there any an animal that you've ever come across that you've had difficulty drawing?
Oh, crikey, yeah. I mean, actually, in Hotel Flamingo, one of the main characters, Lemmy, who's a lemur, and I love lemurs to bits. And I've sort of got a way of making him look, but I find him really hard. Every time I draw him, I have to draw him sort of about five or six times before I get his face looking right again. Because there's many of the characters, when I learn sort of draw them, because you have to go through the whole process of learning a character, just like you would learn, say, learning a song or something. It becomes natural and instinctive to remember how to draw them. And yeah, I normally have nice simple shapes, so their faces might be circles and their bodies are squares, and then you sort of stick them together and you remember where the eyes and ears and stuff go. But I always have trouble with Lemmy, and I don't know what it is, but yes, it's really, really, really weird. I can't, but I get there in the end, so, you know, there's something to be said for keeping going.
As you mentioned songs, not only have you produced this wonderful new book and done all the drawings, but you've also somehow managed to find time to record an album of 8 songs to go with the book.
Yeah, I love music. It's something I've done since I was little. I played cello from the age of sort of 7 or 8 in an orchestra, and I just love the idea of increasing the world, making it even richer. I think, you know, you create these things and why not take them to absolute limits? And obviously I do a lot of school events, so I'm always in schools. And I do drawing with children, but also I do reading and stuff. And actually, one way of really engaging children is to sort of get them to sing along. So there came a point when I thought, I'm going to start taking my guitar in and sit there and try and create some songs that kids can sing along. And so, yes, this was basically just taking it to the next level. And some of the songs I've used in schools already, which is great, and they do work really well. But some of them are just really me, because I like playing the banjo as well. And this world of sort of cabins and wilderness and sort of frontier. And it's very much about folk music and being a part of the landscape and singing about songs about the landscape, you know, so there's songs about storms, songs about the characters. I just really enjoyed it. I love, yeah, let's just say just expanding the world into songs and trying to make it sound fun, but also good. I want to be in a rock star. You know, I want to be in a band. It's like, I want to be everything.
Well, let me let you introduce Albert the Moose.
Well, yeah, hope you enjoy this song, Albert the Moose.
My name is Albert the Moose, always on the loose. I love red apples the best, better than all the rest. And do you know what else? I like those humans as well, Rosa and Anna's well. I like their cabin, it's warm and it cheers me if I'm forlorn. And do you know what else? I like those humans much more when they have apples that I adore. So pick some apples for tea, apples for you and me. And do you know what else? My name is Albert the Moose, always on the loose. I love red apples the best, better than all the rest. And do you know what else? Ooh.
My guest, Alex Milway, singing about Albert the Moose on the album to accompany his Big Sky Mountain series, which is available on Bandcamp, I believe, Alex.
That's right, yeah. I think if you just search for Alex Milway on Bandcamp, it should come up.
And the audiobook version has been brought beautifully to life by narrator Penelope Rawlins.
It's so lovely to hear it realised, because I do a lot of reading of it, but it's never like having someone who can actually do voices properly. And my voices change every time I read it. But yeah, it's really exciting to hear it sort of absolutely brought to life. She gives it such colour and character. It's brilliant.
Rosa clambered over boxes filled with tins of fruit and powdered milk and all the sorts of dried food that might last a year or two in a cupboard. She stepped down and Tom helped her cross the float onto dry land. Grandma Nan stood watching with a puzzled air.
Who's this, then? She asked.
She wiped her thick glasses, hoping cleaner lenses might change her view.
I didn't ask you to bring me a girl, Tom.
It's Rosa, said Rosa. Your granddaughter.
Nan smeared down her bristly shock of hair, it promptly leapt back into place, and walked closer.
Granddaughter, eh?
Said Nan.
Rosa?
I sent you a letter about coming to stay, said Rosa.
She did,
said Tom.
I delivered it myself.
Nan scrunched up her nose in thought.
I don't remember reading a letter, she said. But I do have a granddaughter.
While you discuss this,
said Tom with a smile,
I best get all your supplies out and move on. There's a storm rolling in from the north.
I heard the crows warning of it this morning, said Grandma Nan.
Course you did, Nan,
said Tom.
Penelope Rawlins, narrating Big Sky Mountain, written by my guest, Alex Milway.
So, Alex, I believe that this is the first in a series of four books and that each will focus on a different ecosystem on the mountain.
Yeah, that's right. I've just finished a second book, which is about wolves, and there'll be buffalo. I'm quite fond of wolves, and particularly in Yellowstone Park, they were reintroduced, and they're a big keystone species. And they've done amazing things for bringing everything back to life again, because they sort of help move on the deer, which are really bad at grazing, and they just eat everything. So by having creatures like wolves, it allows other species to come back to life again. And the third one I'm writing at the minute, which is set about coastlines, and I've got sea otters, and I'm going to talk about seaweed and kelp forests and things like that that are getting destroyed, plastic waste. And the final one will be about the air and on top of the mountain, and there'll be sort of tops of trees and lots of bird life and things like that. So, yes, I'm really fascinated. That's the one thing about Big Stone Mountain, was about trying to tie in many of the different ecosystems we have, particularly in Britain and Europe as well.
And it's a fantastic opportunity for children who may well have been cooped up indoors for much of the last 18 months to be reintroduced to the diversity of nature and everything that is hiding in plain sight.
Well, that's really true. I mean, about 6 months ago, we moved south to the coast, because I did live in London. So I've almost sort of gone on the same journey as Rose, although I must admit I live sort of in Hastings, St. Leonard's now. So it's really a town. But we've got the seaside here, and I'm sort of discovering new things that I'd never really seen before, like the plant life that grows on the shingle. And my garden alone has got so many more insects in it than we used to have back in London. And I think it's just exactly that. It's about an opportunity to actually look at what is around you and sort of understand the role that these insects play in the things like bees and pollinating. And yeah, it's just great. I think if nothing else, Big Stone Mountain might get you out and start to look about the world that's around you.
And throughout lockdown, I know that you have been staying in touch with young readers over Zoom and trying out the stories within the Big Sky Mountain series. And you're the co-founder of This Book Is Fun, which aims to remind kids how much fun stories can be.
Yeah, we did that a few years ago. I think humour is really, really important. And it's something that actually doesn't get... It never wins awards, really. There used to be the Roald Dahl Prize, which was cancelled. It must be probably 6 to 8 years ago now. But humour books never win the big prizes. Same as in films, you know, comedy films never win prizes. And I think they're such a good way to get into books, because they are just fun and silly, and you sort of feel attached to the humour. It makes you laugh. You love the books because they've made you laugh, and you really remember it. And when you're little, I mean, I just remember I'd used to love reading comics all the time and love the humour. So yes, I'm really into humour in books. I think it's really important, and that hopefully my books do have some humour in them. That's something I've tried to grow, really get better at writing humour, especially sort of situation-based humour. So there might not be so many jokes, but hopefully the settings and the characters are funny in themselves.
And you've got young children yourself. Do you try all the stories out on your own kids, and are they harsh judges?
Yeah, I do. I'm very lucky, really, actually, that my eldest loves reading. She's absolutely mad for reading. She's always read my books. And I've always asked her, do you like it? What was that? She goes, yeah, it was great. That's basically the response I always get. Yeah, it was great. It never really gets any more critical or in-depth than that. But my younger one, who's 8 now, Arietti, the first Hotel Flamingo book, well, actually, the whole main character is actually based on her. So she can't not like the books, because they're really all about her and her playing with her toys and looking after them. So, yeah, she's not allowed to dislike them.
And do you...
That's fair. I don't know if that's fair.
Are you surrounded by a menagerie of shaggy animals in the house as well?
Oh, yeah. Well, we've got a dog, Aggie, although she's covered in fleas at the minute. So I've got millions of animals in the house, which isn't very much fun. But we're getting through it, thankfully. But yeah, Aggie's brilliant. So you can see her, actually. She's sort of very much in some of the characters. So things that she's done and places she's taken us to and messes she's got into, I definitely, some of those things come out in the characters, and particularly in Hotel Flamingo.
And rumour has it that you've invested in a pair of antlers yourself.
I made them. Yeah, for Hotel Flamingo, I've made this big flamingo hat that I would wear in schools, and made big flamingo wings for kids to wear and to fly around. We did a big disco dance number at the end of my little sort of event. And I thought for this would be really great to have a big moose antler to wear. So I built this thing, but I had to make them foldable so that I could put them in a bag to carry, because I've made them really, really big. They're sort of about a metre either side of my head. So you can't walk upstairs or go through doorways in them. But because they fold, they sort of press down on your head when you're wearing them. So I get a headache from wearing them. But they're really massive. I'm really impressed with how big they are.
Well, that's clearly the author's version of method acting.
Yeah, it is that. I think there's a lot to be said for going the extra mile and dressing up as your characters and singing the songs about your characters. And why not? I'm living it. I'm living the dream.
Well, you're clearly inspiring many, many thousands of children around the world to start their own love of literature. And I hope that you'll come back at the end of the show to tell us about the stories that inspired your own love of literature. But for now, Alex Milway, thank you so much for taking us out onto Big Sky Mountain and for being a guest on Read On.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you ever so much for having me.
Big Sky Mountain is out now in print, ebook, and audio wherever you buy your books. And Alex will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
This is Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, Susanna Forrest on man's long and varied relationship with horses. But before that, this weekend sees the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attacks carried out on the United States on 9/11. Among the many stories of courage and resilience to emerge from that fateful day is that of Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust at Ground Zero. It's a book that I was introduced to by one of Read On's loyal listeners. Here at Read On, we love to know what you're reading and how you access your books. You can contact us by emailing the usual address. One listener who did just that is Jacqueline Brown. She wanted to tell us about a book that she had found both moving and inspirational. Thunderdog by Michael Hingson with Susie Flory. This is the true story of how Hingson's guide dog, Roselle, led him to safety from the burning 78th floor of one of the Twin Towers on 9/11. Let's hear a clip from the talking book.
Roselle snuggled into her favorite spot under my desk. This was her usual office hangout, when not performing her self-assigned duty as greeter. I carefully slid my feet out from under Roselle's sleepy head. Then, just as I stand up and turn to the supply cabinet to get some more letterhead, I hear a tremendous boom. It is 8:46 a.m. The building shudders violently, then starts to groan and slowly tip to the southwest. In slow motion, the tower leans over something like 20 feet. I grew up in earthquake country near the San Andreas Fault in Southern California, so my first instinct is to go and stand in the doorway. But I know this is no earthquake. Roselle stays put under my desk while David clutches it for support. Ceiling tiles fall to the floor. We are both confused. What could that have been? David and I ask. Was it an explosion? Something hitting the building? What could make it tilt that way? Could it be an attack? No, it doesn't make sense to put a bomb that high up. It must be some kind of gas explosion.
Well, I find reading Thunderdog one of the most inspiring books I've ever read, about Michael, who had the guide dog Roselle, and the awful episode in which it took that guide dog to lead that man to safety. And the way the book was told, I sometimes suffer from anxiety, and I always thought back to the book, and I always got the inspiration to overcome the anxiety, and it came into force most of all last year when I was trying to get fit enough to go for my first guide dog, Annie. The book is just a totally inspiring book about a very, very clever man.
We have to get out of here now. I agree, I say. But let's slow down and do it the right way. I want to get our guests out first, then follow after we close up the office. I'd attended many of the World Trade Center emergency training sessions, and we did fire drills every 6 months. I run over the guidelines in my mind. Avoid the elevators, take the stairs, and don't panic. Don't panic. Some may think that might seem easy for me to say, since I can't see the flames, smoke, and debris out the window like David can. Here's the blind guy telling David to do something contrary to what his eyes and his instincts are telling him. I have a good imagination, and I understand what's going on, as much as anyone else could understand such an unexpected and catastrophic event. But what David doesn't understand is that I have a piece of information he does not have. When the debris began to fall and the flames leaped out of the floors above us, and even while the people in the conference room screamed, Roselle sat next to me, as calm as ever. She does not sense any danger in the flames, smoke, or anything else that is going on around us. If she had sensed danger, she would have acted differently. But she does not. I choose to trust Roselle's judgment, and so I will not panic. Roselle and I are a team.
I had applied for my guide dog the actual year of 9/11. And it wasn't long after that I'd passed my assessment to get a guide dog. Obviously, it was on the news that my mum heard about the dog, the guide dog, Roselle, getting Michael out of the building. And another bit that really touched me when he was telling his story was the fact that when the firefighters offered to help him out, and he says, no, we're fine. If the lights go out, him and Roselle were quite capable of leading the mum down, obviously with Roselle's training and a close partnership that she had with Michael. You know, he was such an unselfish man. And the bit that really touched me was when he says, like Roselle licking the firefighters and that was the last piece of unconditional love, which is true. And a guide dog giving you, they give you 100% unconditional love. Not just guide dogs, all dogs. And they ask for so little in return. And I think, as I say, I've had Thunder Dog out 4 times. And each time I listen to it, that inspiration's always there to carry on.
The impact creates a vibration that travels through my feet and up my legs, and the street feels like a trampoline bouncing. A jolt of fear rips through me and my throat freezes. I can't even scream. David cries, "Oh my God!" and starts running. In a split second's time, I swing 180 degrees, lifting Roselle up bodily and spinning around with a deep grip on her harness, and we break into a run too. We are running for our lives. No one is helping anyone anymore, except for Roselle and me. We are still there for each other.
Thunderdog, the true story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust at Ground Zero by Michael Hinkson with Susie Flory is available in Braille and as TB20319. Thanks again to Jacqueline Brown for recommending such a moving and inspirational story. And to mark the 20th anniversary of 9/11, listen out for a special episode of Talking Books featuring the abridged version of Thunderdog, the true story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust at Ground Zero.
Hi, everybody. My name is Callum Russell, and I am from an organisation called Crystallize, which supports blind and vision impaired people to fulfil their potential and ambitions, either in higher education or employment. My favourite audiobook by far is The Runaway Jury by John Grisham. And I like this book because you just have no idea where the story's going, how it's all going to end, from the minute you open the book to the minute you close the book at the end of it, metaphorically speaking, of course. I love listening to audiobooks because you can listen to them anywhere. It could be in your bed, it could be in your sitting room, it could even be out and about whilst you're on a train. My particular favourite is, of course, an aeroplane, particularly on those long flights to America or the Far East, where you need to kill time, and an audiobook is a fantastic way of actually being able to do that. For me, audiobooks are a massive, massive positive for blind and vision impaired people, particularly for those who use Braille. I remember the days of going on holiday with my favourite books, and they used to take up so much room in the suitcase or rucksack, because a John Grisham thriller could be as big as 9 or 10 Braille volumes. Whereas the great benefit of audiobooks is that you can take them with you on your mobile phone or your iPad. And how much space does a mobile phone or an iPad take up? Very little. So yes, if you're into your thrillers and you want a book that grabs your attention from the minute you start it to the minute you finish it, I cannot recommend The Runaway Jury highly enough.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Alex Milway to share the books of his life... Although anthropologists generally agree that dogs were the first animals to be domesticated, horses have also had a long-standing place in human history. As I found out when I met Susanna Forrest in a noisy cafe at the Wigtown Book Festival a couple of years ago. But first, here's a clip.
Consider the metamorphosis of the wild horse into a Nazi symbol. They recall the dancing horses that lent discipline to the court of Louis XIV and held the citizens of London, Paris and New York spellbound, and the dray horses that were recast as royal mounts and solar engines. They show how horse meat influenced presidential elections and inspired terrorist attacks, and they examine the complicated relationship between the value and worth of steeds coveted by Chinese emperors at the expense of their human subjects. Lastly, they give form to the political and emotional lives of equines themselves and the way that their own nature enabled them to go to war in our service. History is generally not told from the perspective of the horse. All attempts are obviously mere ventriloquy. Its acceptance of us and our actions never ceases to baffle, but it's that cooperation, whether driven by neuroendocrinology, the need to eat, fear, behavioural or genetic manipulation, that has enabled mankind to conquer tremendous territories, feed and clothe nations, and calm the damaged. Whether the horse likes it or not, it has been given a place of privilege among other animals and called a comrade. It has also been grossly misused. Such are the costs and losses of being co-opted by a fellow mammal who has both saved the horse from extinction and destroyed it in numbers never tallied. Here then are a handful of the stories we have told ourselves about horses over thousands of years, and 6 tales of the creature that the Comte de Buffon, a French naturalist, called in a telling paradox, the most noble conquest of mankind.
Pearl Hewitt, narrating The Age of the Horse, written by Susanna Forrest, who I met at the Wigtown Book Festival.
I'd never realised, Susanna, that horses were originally domesticated as farm animals for milk and other products.
Yeah, there's a slightly gory history of us using lots of horse parts, but these people, the Botai in Kazakhstan in the Copper Age, which is about 3,500 BC, they seem to be the first people who tamed horses, at least, and they may have ridden them. It looks like they used bits, but what they definitely did was milk horses and use pretty much every part of their body to build houses. They used the dung, they used bones for tools, and they presumably used leather as well. So it was intensive from the beginning with domestication.
And I tend to think of horses as being used on farms to pull ploughs and help transport crops. That came somewhat later then?
Well, horses were used in agriculture, but they became sort of used intensively basically when ploughs and other equipment improved so much that they weren't so heavy that they needed oxen to pull them. And then horses became more and more commonplace at that point because they were 50% faster.
And when did they become the major form of transport for human beings?
Probably, I mean, it's the 19th century because people were just moving a lot more. A larger percentage of the population moved. The roads were better. Rail was invented and you needed horses to get to railways and get away from railways. And then within cities, quite soon, basically there were more horses in the cities than the country because they ran trams, buses, vans, cabs. You know, if you needed to get to the hospital, that was how you did it. Everything was done pretty much by horsepower after a while.
And of course, even when steam took over, horses have been used in mining and transportation.
Yeah, the last pit pony retired in Britain in 1997, I think. And some businesses converted to cars and vans and then converted back in the 1930s, actually, because there was still the manpower and the skill at that time, and it was cheaper to use horses. I spent time with organic farmers in America who were pointing out to me that if you have a farm under a certain size, and people knew this in the 1950s as well, under a certain size, it's more efficient to farm with horses. For obvious reasons, you don't have any fuel costs, and you can replace one horse by getting it to produce a new horse. Whereas if you have a tractor, one farmer I talked to had started out with tractors, sold them, bought horses instead, and over 10 years he'd made a five-figure profit from the horses, whereas the tractor he would have just had to sell and then buy a brand new tractor. So it's instead of losing costs, you're actually making costs. So it's interesting that that's partly the reason people are going back to farming with horses in some places.
That's encouraging to hear. And of course, horses are also used in a therapeutic way as well.
Yeah, there's actually quite a long history of that. I mean, even I think Galen, who's the sort of Greek physician, recommended horse riding and chariot riding as a health activity. And then the 20th century, really riding for people with disabilities, often war veterans begin. So I talked a bit about side saddle earlier, and a lot of people who fought in the First World War and lost limbs used side saddles after the war to go riding, and they're still used in para dressage, for example. And I keep finding earlier and earlier examples of para riders long before the Paralympics. A woman riding up Oxford Street with no hands, or I think there was someone who had lost her sight who was hunting. Yeah, in the early 18th century, there's a very terrifying Marchioness of Salisbury, I think, who, when she got very old and couldn't see anymore, she basically took out a groom on horseback who would tell her when the jumps were coming up and say, "Jump, my lady, damn it." So we kind of use horses' bodies as extensions and products in all kinds of ways, and they work sort of, I mean, the soldiers that I saw in the US who were working with horses had physical problems, part paralysis, but they also had problems with brain damage and traumatic stress disorder. And this sort of combination of the physical and the mental that you need with horses was very, very helpful for them.
And actually, I believe the UK has just got its first Falabella guide horse, but it's quite a big thing in the States, I understand.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of service horses in America, but I hadn't heard this about the Falabella in the UK, because they're magically tiny horses. I think probably a bit more biddable than Shetlands as well, if you're looking for a a guide horse.
My pony mad 15-year-old would be very happy if I got a Falabella. I must ask you to repeat the wonderful story of Morocco, the Elizabethan performing horse.
There were obviously all kinds of street performers across history working with horses, and he got particularly famous. I think he's mentioned by Shakespeare and Donne. Morocco, he could count. He apparently climbed up St. Paul's Cathedral. That was one of the things, well, up the stairs, which was challenging enough for a horse. He could dance a jig and bow for the Queen, and he could be sent out into the audience to pick out a certain person as well. There's supposedly a conversation that his owner got into with a bishop about whether there was witchcraft involved, and the horse solved this by bowing to the sign of a cross when his owner held it up. I also mentioned a less fortunate English performing horse who was supposedly burnt in Lisbon at the stake, basically. So Morocco, I think, survived, but not so all of these intelligent horses.
You came across a more modern case of a horse in Germany, where you now live, which might explain how Morocco did his marvellous magical tricks.
Yeah, this is the early 20th century, is a horse called Clever Hans. He literally lived about 10 minutes away from me. And his owner had trained a previous horse, but didn't get that far. And with this horse, he trained him. He could spell. He could do quite complicated sums. He seemed to be accumulating all kinds of knowledge. And what people eventually realized was happening was that it wasn't that he could count. He was basically watching his owner. So the owner would say, what's 3 plus 4? Clever Hans would strike the ground 7 times, and then he would notice that his owner had relaxed, and then he would stop striking the ground. So he was a clever horse. You know, he was looking for these tiny, tiny signals, but he wasn't really doing quite what everybody thought he was doing.
Amazingly empathetic, though, for an animal to be that in tune with their human owner.
Yeah, I think a lot of the time we interact with horses, quite often horses in riding schools who have had a lot of conflicting signals and confusing signals from humans, so they're not that sensitive. So when you do come across a horse that hasn't lost that, or that's been treated the right way by people, it's really fascinating, because they are much, much more intelligent and intuitive and often interested in us than we give them credit. But we sometimes end up punishing them for the way that they are responding quite naturally to us. So it's a really interesting edge to horse care at the moment, that people are trying to work out ways to teach people to interact with them in a way that doesn't confuse and shut down the horses.
Yes, no longer breaking in the horse, but working with the horse.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, people are now getting quite radical with this and sort of letting the horse like explore the equipment and almost choose which equipment is used. And I'm impressed by people that can do that. I think you maybe need a lot of land and space. It's not something that people will be doing at urban riding schools in the near future, but it's interesting that they're doing it.
And finally, do you have a favourite horse story that you either came across in your research or a novel like Black Beauty that you read when you were a child that made you fall in love with horses?
Oh, yeah. It's almost impossible to do favourites, but because we're in Wigtown, I would mention a wonderful series of novels that influenced me a lot when I was a teenager and a child, by a Scottish writer from Kilmalcolm, which I think is not that far away, called Patricia Leach. And people tend to dismiss pony books. They're like, oh, it's just girls and ponies and pony club. But these are really kind of about basically sort of Buddhist principles and big questions in life. And they're all set on the moorland around Kilmalcolm, and partly also on Skye I found the original of the house that's in the book, and they're really, really wonderful, and I would love to see them have a revival.
Susanna Forrest, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's lovely talking to you.
The Age of the Horse by Susanna Forrest is out now in print and audio wherever you buy your books.
Are you living with sight loss? RNIB's free, informal, community-based courses and phone groups provide information, advice, support and practical solutions for people with sight loss and those close to them. We'll help you adjust to your sight condition, increase your independence and boost your confidence. Come and share experiences with others in a similar situation and find out about services available to you. We offer a range of courses, 4 days, 2 days, 1 day specialist days, and continuous phone groups. To find out about courses in your area, email us on lwslenquiries@rnib.org.uk or phone us on 0300 123 3933 or visit our website rnib.org.uk/living with sight loss.
Hi, I'm Joe Kenny. Audiobooks have been a huge part of my life, certainly from a child and when I became a teenager and then all through my adult life. I remember so fondly like the Talking Book Library and waiting on the Talking Book and the sound and the feel of the big Talking Book players and having to, you know, switch tracks and all that sort of, the kind of ceremony of it all. I mean, it's hard to pick favourite books. I'm not sure if I have a favourite book. But I certainly remember back then reading stuff like, you know, I was big into like sci-fi and fantasy and stuff and all that kind of thing. I remember reading like a lot of Stephen King books. I remember reading James Herbert. I remember reading War of the Worlds. As I said, Stephen King, Pet Sematary, kind of books like that left a sort of a lasting impression on me growing up. Recently, I now consume my books on my iPhone now. And one of the best books I've read recently, I've just finished it actually, is How to Make It in the New Music Business by Ari Hirstand. It's just a fabulous book if you're a musician or songwriter and you just want to really learn the modern, contemporary way of making money out of music, basically. And he's just written this fabulous book. And in the audiobook, he actually reads it himself. And you just get such a strong impression of his own sort of passion for the subject and why he wants to impart this knowledge. And I thoroughly enjoyed that, and I thoroughly recommend it to anybody who's a musician or songwriter. I suppose, looking back a few years ago, I remember I discovered the Pilgrim series of books by Sebastian Bonskiewicz. I hope I got that surname right. Fabulous set of books. Again, sort of sci-fi fantasy stuff, but just so well written, and I just thoroughly enjoyed them. I just love audiobooks and just can't get enough, really. I find the difficulty is sort of limiting yourself or putting sort of time constraints so you know when to switch off and go and do something else, like, you know, go and cook a meal or something, because sometimes just time escapes you and you just end up hours pass and you've read all that time, but it's such a great way of passing some time. I love it.
Now it's back to Alex Milway for the books of his life.
Alex, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Oh, yeah, well, I probably, like with many kids of my age, because I grew up in the 80s, there wasn't actually many children's books. You basically had a few authors that you would read from, unlike today, which is amazing. So really, the one that I really love and still remember is The Witches by Roald Dahl, which probably everybody loves and has read. But I loved it. I loved the fact it was a little boy off turned into a mouse. It didn't have particularly the ending you'd imagine it to have, so it was quite exciting in that way. And he had a really great grandma, which obviously you can, as you tell from Big Sky Mountains, it was quite important to me at the time. So, yeah, The Witches by Roald Dahl.
A note about witches. In fairy tales, witches always wear silly black hats and black cloaks, and they ride on broomsticks. But this is not a fairy tale. This is about real witches. The most important thing you should know about real witches is this. Listen very carefully. Never forget what is coming next. Real witches dress in ordinary clothes and look very much like ordinary women. They live in ordinary houses and they work in ordinary jobs. That is why they are so hard to catch. A real witch hates children with a red-hot, sizzling hatred that is more sizzling and red-hot than any hatred you could possibly imagine. A real witch spends all her time plotting to get rid of the children in her particular territory. Her passion is to do away with them one by one. It is all she thinks about the whole day long. Even if she's working as a cashier in a supermarket, or typing letters for a businessman, or driving round in a fancy car, and she could be doing any of these things, her mind will always be plotting and scheming and churning and burning and whizzing and fizzing with murderous, bloodthirsty thoughts. "Which child?" she says to herself all day long. "Exactly which child shall I choose for my next squelching?" A real witch gets the same pleasure from squelching a child as you get from eating a plateful of strawberries and thick cream.
Pauline Munro narrating The Witches by Roald Dahl, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, I'm a massive Moomin fan, and there's one that just always draws me back to it, and I love many of them, but Moominland Midwinter is the one I would just read over and over again, because it just feels so wonderful, especially if it's maybe a cold and snowy day outside, and you can just sit down and get lost in this lovely, completely sort of alien landscape that's all white and snowy and totally unlike the normal world. And just Moomin going on an adventure, Moomin, and meeting new characters in the place that normally is so normal to him. It's completely flipped. Moominland Midwinter.
Inside, the house was warm and cosy. Heaps of peat were quietly smouldering in the central heating stove down in the cellar. The moon looked in sometimes at the drawing room window, lighting on the white winter covers of the chairs and on the cut glass chandelier and its white gauze bag. And in the drawing room also, grouped around the biggest porcelain stove of the house, the Moomin family lay sleeping their long winter sleep. They always slept from November to April, because such was the custom of their forefathers, and Moomins stick to tradition. Everybody had a good meal of pine needles in their stomachs, just as their ancestors used to have, and beside their beds they had hopefully laid out everything likely to be needed in early spring. Spades, burning glasses and films, wind gauges and the like. The silence was deep and expectant. Every now and then, somebody sighed and curled deeper down under the quilt. The streak of moonlight wandered from rocking chair to drawing room table, crawled over the brass knobs of the bed end, and shone straight in Moomintroll's face. And now, something happened that had never happened before. Not since the first Moomin took to his hibernating den. Moomintroll awoke and found that he couldn't go back to sleep again. He looked at the moonlight and the ice ferns on the window. He listened to the humming of the stove in the cellar and felt more and more awake and astonished. Finally he rose and padded over to Moomin Mama's bed. He pulled at her ear very cautiously, but she didn't awake. She just curled into an uninterested ball.
Hugh Dennis narrating Moominland Midwinter by Tove Jansson, which is available commercially.
Finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, so I said I read lots of nature books, and one that absolutely massively inspires me, and particularly to write Big Sky Mountain, is a book called Eager by Ben Goldfarb, and it is all about beavers, particularly in America, though. He does come and talk about, there's the few that have been released in Britain, and there's just great stories about beavers in it and how brilliant they are. And I have one particular story about them being reintroduced into wilderness areas in America where they were dropped by parachute, these little beavers, and landed in the middle of nowhere, which is what I picked and used as a little bit of the start of the beaver introduction into Big Sky Mountain. So yeah, it's just great stories about beavers and how amazing they are.
Close your eyes. Picture, if you will, a healthy stream. What comes to mind? Perhaps you've conjured a crystalline, fast-moving creek, bounding merrily over rocks, its course narrow and shallow enough that you could leap or wade across the channel. If, like me, you are a fly fisherman, you might add a cheerful, knee-deep angler, casting for trout in a limpid riffle. It's a lovely picture, fit for an Orvis catalog. It's also wrong. Let's try again. This time, I want you to perform a more difficult, imaginative feat. Instead of envisioning a present-day stream, I want you to reach into the past, before the mountain men, before the pilgrims, before Hudson and Champlain and the other horsemen of the furpocalypse, all the way back to the 1500s. I want you to imagine the streams that existed before global capitalism purged a continent of its dam-building, water-storing, wetland-creating engineers. I want you to imagine a landscape with its full complement of beavers. What do you see this time? No longer is our stream a pellucid, narrow, racing trickle. Instead, it's a sluggish, murky swamp, backed up several acres by a messy concatenation of woody dams. Gnawed stumps ring the marsh like punji sticks. Dead and dying trees stand aslant in the chest-deep pond. When you step into the water, you feel not rocks underfoot, but sludge. The musty stink of decomposition wafts into your nostrils. If there's a fisherman here, he's thrashing angrily in the willows, his fly caught in a tree.
Will Damron narrating Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter by Ben Goldfarb, which is available commercially.
Alex Milway, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thanks again. Thanks ever so much.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Redsail, which is REDSZELL, and Robert Kirkwood is at talking_books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.